spending more on flood defences over the next 4 years than over the last 4 years. There's a lot of flood defences being built. Something like 80,000 houses were protected this time, but we've got to do more.
Five of the six Britons jailed after a Greenpeace protest in the Arctic have arrived back in London. They've been released as part of a Russian amnesty. One of them, Alex Harris, says spending time in jail was torture. She says it's good to be back.
It's not great that we got amnesty because it's like they're saying that they forgive us for what we did and we didn't do anything wrong. However, at the same time, I'm glad this case is over.
British authorities are waiting for post-mortem examination results for a British doctor who died in custody in Syria. An inquest has heard the country's regime claim that Dr. Abbas Khan took his own life, but his family are adamant he was murdered. Police have confirmed a man who died at a house in Burcotes near Doncaster suffered suspected shotgun injuries. The 37-year-old man's body was discovered this morning. A woman who was also shot is seriously ill in hospital. That's the latest. I'm Simon English.
This Christmas morning, 80,000 children will wake up homeless in Great Britain. Children like Lucy, evicted from her home and now facing a cold, frightening Christmas in a hostel. This is no place for a child. Jack worries about sharing a bathroom with strangers. Some nights he wets the bed. And Jess is exhausted by the 2-hour journey to school from her hostel. No child should be homeless, especially at this time of year. Please, help us find them a home this Christmas. Call 08000 8050 40 or text HOME to 70060 to give just £3 to shelter. For over 40 years, we've been helping families find a place they can call home. But we can't do it without your support. Please, call shelter now on 08000 8050 40 while there's still time. Thank you.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2. The station you can count on.
It's Friday, we're live, it's 5 o'clock, and BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. Well, our politicians are all off on their holidays, helping us review this week's news is Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. After the 6 o'clock news, we review our pick of the year's big stories and the extraordinary revelation that our own intelligence services spend more of our time and money spying on us than they do on our so-called enemies. So what are they so afraid of? Plus Edward Snowden's Christmas message. He's the whistleblower from the National Security Agency, a contractor there. The story that links terrorism in Europe carried out by NATO to the United States 9/11 and London's 7/7 bombings. It's got to be the biggest suppressed story in the Western world. Our media don't want to touch it, but international satellite channel RT will, even if YouTube fiddle the figures, as some believe. And Boris Johnson reveals, doesn't he, this year, that never mind what we were told as children, greed is good. Plus, the brilliant but little heard from pressure group, Independent Diplomat. We hear their founder, Karl Ross's views on the Commonwealth meeting in Sri Lanka and British trade missions to China. Speaking of which, Hinkley Point's new nuclear power station to be run by a totalitarian one-party state which executes some of its critics. Will it ever really happen? And finally, a bit of a nasty one for me. This time last year, I received death threats by phone from an international terrorist organisation. I'll let you hear them and explain what happened when I went to the police. It's all in the second hour after 6 o'clock, but we are going to actually do a news review. It's one of those times, isn't it? They bury bad news. So we'll be doing some of that this time of the year in the first hour. On to the news review in a minute. First, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Pleased to say we got it roughly right. Fairly mild and sunny over Christmas and Boxing Day. Tonight, though, dry and mild. This weekend, sunny periods tomorrow and dry, more sunny on Sunday. Next week, around 7 or 8 degrees Celsius. Rain on Monday and through into the new year. Should be clearing up though by Thursday on the 2nd of January and Friday to give some more sunny periods. Next weekend, that's the 4th and 5th of January, warm on Saturday, cold on Sunday. That's rain on Saturday, clearing hopefully to cloud on Sunday. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Well, welcome to a cosy studio, Martin Summers. Nice and warm in here. What we're going to do is just go through some of the stories this week. Particularly, I brought in a copy of Inside Housing. It's a bit of a sort of insular magazine, just looking at the housing world. But what strikes me about this is on the front page here, we've got a 300% increase in rising damp. What they're saying on the front of the magazine is landlords are reporting a surge in mould complaints as squeezed tenants underheat their homes.
Well, I mean, it's typical of, it's one another problem that we've got in our housing sector. It's clearly the big Achilles heel of the British economy. We've got a housing bubble racing away now in the southeast of England. Meanwhile, house prices in places like Blackpool are stagnant. We've got a huge homelessness crisis, as we heard in the shelter advert at the beginning of the hour. And, you know, the situation on housing in this country is a disgrace, frankly.
Well, there isn't, doesn't seem to be a lot of investment in housing. Why is that at the moment? I mean, in existing housing, landlords don't seem to want to actually put the money into upkeep.
Well, I mean, the social housing sector is being squeezed through spending cuts. And the private housing sector, essentially, we've restarted the buy-to-let bubble. And what that means is that basically people cut corners. They're just looking to make a profit from the rising value of the house. And to do that, you don't have to do very much. So, and this, of course, has always been the Achilles heel of the British economy. And we started to get obsessed with home ownership in this country in the 1920s. Conservative governments in that era thought that if we can encourage people to buy their own houses, then they're less likely to go on strike, because, of course, you can't go on strike, really, if you've got to pay a mortgage. And they're all more likely to vote Conservative. And that's certainly the case, that people in private, you know, who own their own homes or are buying their own homes do tend to vote Conservative more often. But that has led to a huge distortion in the British economy, where we've got a massive, there's always an incipient property bubble in the southeast. And they're now talking in terms of, well, we'll have to raise interest rates because of this property bubble. But of course, what that does is that makes exporters in the north of England, north of the Wash, who are metal bashers traditionally, makes it more difficult for them to borrow money. And of course, the pound goes up as a result of all of this, which makes it more difficult for them to export, which is why Britain has gradually been industrialised over the 20th century, because we're obsessed with property ownership.
But we're deindustrialised now, aren't we?
Well, we are. That's what the whole point. The 20th century, we've deindustrialised, and what we instead of making gadgets that people want to buy, we've become a nation of DIY fanatics. We're really good at conservatories and loft extensions and so on. But of course, you can't sell them to the Chinese.
Now, listening to Radio Bristol this morning, they had a guy called Darren, who's a prospective parliamentary candidate for the local Labour Party. I think he's
Darren Lewis.
I think he's also chair of, and he was trying to explain Labour Party policy on this, which is to have a temporary freeze in energy prices. And John Darville on the BBC was pointing out it's absolutely pointless, because before you get to power, the energy company is going to put the prices up anyway.
Well, I mean, that's a slightly different topic. Energy and housing are related.
This is to do with this rising damp.
Yeah, but I mean, I was treating it as a general question
about
housing.
People not being able to afford to heat their homes.
Well, I think what's happened with the threat to freeze energy prices is quite interesting, because as you say, there are all sorts of ways they can get round it. They can raise the prices in advance and so on. But what it's doing is it's saying we will intervene in the energy market one way or another. Now, don't forget that Ed Miliband has also got people within his own party, Peter Mandelson would be an obvious candidate, who are very unhappy about any attempt to intervene in markets. And so is the City of London and so on. And they all kicked off. But in actual fact, it was an overwhelming success with the public. And I believe on Question Time, it was that various people were saying, well, why are these energy companies in the private sector anyway? And of course, that is the question. Why are they in the private sector? They are public utilities. They should never have been privatised. They were private, and the gas the same. They were privatised in the Thatcher era, and of course, she passed away this year. And nobody has pointed out that virtually all the policies she pursued, including the privatisation of the energy market, have led to disaster for this country. And that is actually, that's the time scale we're on. We've had 30 years of idiotic policies, and now we're on the brink of disaster. And of course, at the same time, it's being presented as, oh, but it's great, the economy's growing, the bubble's rising, we're going to get re-elected, everything's fine. It's not. We're going to crash.
But we live in a democracy. It's all our own fault, isn't it?
Well, no, do we live in a democracy? This is a question. There are two aspects to the question of whether we live in a democracy. One is, does the government decide policy, or is it the energy companies, like we saw with INEOS in Scotland, threatening to close down supply to all of the petrol stations across the country unless they got their own way? And the energy companies are saying that if there was a price freeze put on them, that they might have to cut off the power. Now, if they were run by the government, the people running those companies would not be able to threaten to cut off the power if they didn't get their own way. So there are questions, and it's worse with the bankers, of course. They're the real blackmailers. So the question is, does any government have the power to do anything about bankers, energy companies, etc.? And then the other question is, how democratic is our political system? We have a first-past-the-post system, unique in Western Europe, which basically means on a minority of the votes, a government can form an administration which has total power, and then within that administration, total power is then concentrated in the Prime Minister's office. So we have a far more concentrated system than the US, for example. The British Prime Minister really is in charge, except that he gets told to do what to do by the banks. And in any case, the British Prime Minister doesn't have a majority of the votes. Our system is no longer a two-party system, if it ever was. We've got the Plaid Cymru, the SNP, Liberal Democrats, the Greens, UKIP now, and of course that really makes it a lottery who wins, because of the first-past-the-post system, the biggest parties always win and the small parties don't get properly represented.
Getting back to energy policy, though, and people being able to afford to heat their homes, I mean, it's one of the first things that goes, isn't it, when people just don't have enough money to survive on, is because you can always wrap up a bit warmer leave the heating off. But what it's leading to is a terrible conditions of these houses. They're deteriorating fast.
Well, our housing stock, in any case, is in a very poor shape. In Germany, new houses have to be zero emissions. So everything they do is geared around saving energy, whereas in Britain, we've got the smallest houses in Europe per square metre and the price and all the rest of it, and they're some of the worst insulated, and they're just not designed to save energy. And all of this is, again, to do with the short term, we're in for a quick buck, let's just line our own pockets and to hell with the future attitude, which we seem to be specialising in this country.
Well, you mentioned Margaret Thatcher there. That was quite a big event of the year. We're supposed to be just doing this last week or so's news in the first hour, but can't resist actually having a listen now to the speech by Boris Johnson at the first Margaret Thatcher lecture. And this is where he's talking about basically people's IQ being somehow, if you've got a high IQ, you should be rich. What are your thoughts, before we hear it, Martin, what are your thoughts on that initial concept? If you're an intelligent person, surely you should be rich. Isn't that right?
Well, just logically, I would say that some intelligent people are rich, and some intelligent people aren't rich. Some stupid people are rich, and some stupid people aren't rich. So, in actual fact, just on a logical point of view, the idea that intelligence causes people to be rich, I think, is patently wrong. Some intelligent people do get rich, but lots of stupid people are rich.
Is it maybe something also to do with morality? I mean, you can use your intelligence to, you know, get get a win a march over other people, or you can use it in a more generous way, in a more community minded way.
Indeed, Nelson Mandela never got rich. He did actually make some money once he got out of prison, I presume, but in actual fact he spent his whole life serving other people and serving a cause. And lots of people do that. Doctors and nurses who go to work in war zones and so on, they're not doing it to get rich, are they? Like that doctor that died in Syria, he wasn't doing it to get rich, was he? And he certainly didn't get rich.
So someone needs to tell Boris there's more values in this world than just money and a financial and how much is in your
bank account. What he's doing is he's manoeuvring to be the next leader of the Tory party, and he knows that the kind of people who will have a vote on that want to hear that greed is good, and that's why he's saying it. But I think from a Labour Party point of view, that just shows that a fight is breaking out within the Conservative Party for the leadership, because they know they're going to lose the next election.
So greed is good. Do you think that's actually a vote winner? Secretly people kind of agree
with
that?
It's a vote winner for the bankers that back the Tory party with their funds, but whether it will run with the electorate at large, I very much doubt.
Okay, to Boris then, with no more ado.
I accept the CPS view that greed is a valid motivator of economic progress. It was Margaret Thatcher who made the key observation about charity in her famous analysis of the parable of the Good Samaritan. He wouldn't have been much use to the chap who fell amongst thieves, she noted, the Good Samaritan, if he had not been rich enough to help. Britain is competing in an increasingly impatient and globalised economy in which the competition is getting ever stiffer. And no one can ignore the harshness of that competition, or the inequality that it inevitably accentuates. And I'm afraid that violent economic centrifuge is operating on human beings who are already very far from equal in raw ability, if not in spiritual worth. Whatever you may think of the value of IQ tests, it is surely relevant to a conversation about equality that as many as 16% of our species have an IQ below 85, while about 2%, but anyway, 16%, what do you want to put up your hands? 16% have an IQ below 85, 2% have an IQ above 130. And the harder you shake the pack, the easier it will be for some cornflakes to get to the top. And for one reason or another, boardroom greed, or as the people in the boardrooms assure me, the natural and God-given talents of senior executives, the income gap between the top cornflakes and the bottom cornflakes is getting wider than ever. And I stress, I don't believe that economic equality is possible. Indeed, some measure of inequality is essential for the spirit of envy and keeping up with the Joneses and so on. That is a valuable spur to economic activity. We may not have gunboats anymore as we did in the days when we invaded or conquered 171 members of the UN, but we hardly need gunboats anymore because we are already fulfilling what I think of our destiny as the soft power capital of the world. And that, to conclude, is very largely thanks to a woman who knew all about soft power and hard power, and above all, about the deep Freudian terror that every man possesses for the inner recesses of a handbag.
Boris Johnson there speaking a couple of months ago. The Margaret Thatcher lecture, Martin. Soft power, he talks about there. Britain, London is the capital, the world capital of soft power.
Well, let's unpick that a little. London is the capital of international finance. And throughout the 1980s, into the 90s and to today, a massive tribute flows into the city of London as a result of the indebtedness of developing countries. The indebtedness which was forced on them by the oil price shock in the late 70s initially, but which they've never been able to get out of. So that what keeps people wealthy in the southeast of London and their property values high is not their IQs, it's the endless tribute that's paid by developing countries. So a country like Argentina, for example, half of their taxes, perhaps, I don't know what the exact figure is for Argentina, goes to pay off debts run up by the military government in Argentina and still never repaid. Sub-Saharan Africa, the same. Now, in actual fact, Boris Johnson is revealing more than he realises. He says, we don't have to send a gunboat anymore. We just do it through the financial system. But, of course, if you stand in our way, like Saddam Hussein or the Taliban, then we do send a gunboat. Of course, the thing is, when we get there, we don't win. We lost twice in Afghanistan in the 19th century. We lost in Iraq. We're losing in Afghanistan now. And we're not just losing money. We're losing credibility.
But we won in Libya, didn't we?
Did we? I noticed there was a massive car bomb in Libya attacking the new armed forces there. Libya is breaking up into a failed state. Might it make more sense to have tried to reform Gaddafi than just turn it into a failed state? Who knows? I mean, in Iraq, over the weekend, over the holiday, scores of Christians were killed in Sunni terrorist bombs, at least we presume they were Sunni terrorist bombs, but who knows? In the world we live in now, bombs are going off all the time. People are claiming responsibility. We're not quite sure who did any of them. And the Western intelligence services have definitely had their finger in these kind of pies for many years, including in Syria, for example, where it's quite clear the Daily Express was saying that British special forces have been in Syria training the rebels. So it's the usual arrogance of the British ruling class that we're hearing from Boris Johnson. And, of course, his real constituency, the people in front of him in the audience, are the bankers. It's the Margaret Thatcher lecture being held, and most of the people there are the bankers. He's made the little joke, anybody here with an IQ below 85? Ha, 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 ha. Incidentally, by the way, I know my IQ because my parents were teachers. They actually got access to my IQ level, and I was one of the last people to do the 11 plus, and it's 133. So I'm in the top 2%, supposedly. But I'm not rich, Tony. Why is that?
Well, it's strange. It doesn't quite fit with Boris's view of things. Another story. Again, this week is an interesting week for news because there's a lot of stories have crept out. One of them is to do with Serco. Apparently, Serco, this is the company that was caught lying to the government about how many people they'd tagged. Many of them were actually in prison rather than out and tagged, and some of them were dead. And this was millions of pounds extra that they'd taken from us, the taxpayer. But that doesn't seem to matter. Serco have won a 22-year contract expansion from the Ministry of Justice yesterday, the very same ministry that they were lying to and cheating, which is worth £120 million. That's just one day after repaying £68.5 million over the prisoner tagging scandal. The group will build an extension at HM Prison Thameside in Greenwich, giving the 900 prisoner jail space for another 332 inmates. So the message here really is, if you want to cheat the government, that's fine. We might catch you out, but if we do, don't worry about the contract. We'll just roll it over.
Well, indeed, and it's basically crony capitalism is the term that might be used for this. And, of course, the other thing is that the things about security, any kind of security, I mean, we could actually have competing British armies, couldn't we? We could have three or four different suppliers for who was going to send regiments to Afghanistan, and we could see who put in the lowest bid.
Well, they
could
maybe fight each other in war games, and then the best one we could send out.
Yeah, but it's all to do with price, the price they're offering, you see. But, of course, in actual fact, that's not realistic, is it? If the British government is going to have an organisation like Serco running security operations of one kind or another, they have to be given all kinds of inside information that allows them to do that, you know, including access to files and so on. But once you've done that, you can't really give the contract to anybody else, can you? Because they've got you over a barrel, which is why all these things were in the public sector in the first place, back in the bad old days in the Second World War and so on. Did we have private services providing prisoner of war camps and so on? I don't think we did we?
Another sneaky little news story. I've got a copy of The Eye here, which is not just for the price, but it's actually a very good spread, I think, very good read. It's a sort of journalist's newspaper. That's the way I see it anyway. You've got you've got all sorts of different values, and also a lot of stories pop up in here that you don't see elsewhere. Diplomacy, a US general with his finger on the button and a foot in his mouth. This is a pretty shocking one. A US Air Force general in charge of nuclear weapons repeatedly drank too much and displayed behaviour unbecoming of a gentleman last summer during an official trip to Moscow, where he insulted his hosts and was seen with two suspicious women he met at a hotel bar, according to an investigative report. Major General Michael Carey, commander of the Air Force's arsenal of land-based intercontinental ballistic missiles, acted in a manner that exceeded the limits of accepted standards of good conduct during his four-day visit to Moscow in July. Major General Carey was fired in October from his job as commander of the 20th Air Force, which is responsible for maintaining and operating the country's intercontinental ballistic missiles.
Well, it may be that this is what it appears to be. The guy has just, you know, had a bit of a wild time in Moscow and blotted his copybook. But of course, one can also ask the question, is there more to this? Is he being removed for some other reason, either because he's opposed to the Obama presidency, perhaps, or because he's basically in cahoots with the Russians or whatever? I mean, when I hear things like that, I think there's something more to this. You don't remove generals for drinking too much and hanging out with women.
So what the question is, which is not in the article, which is who has replaced him and what's his political allegiances?
Well, indeed,
and his
indeed.
Track record.
As it says in Machiavelli's The Prince, the most dangerous thing to be is a successful general, because basically people are out to get you. Now, it may be that this guy is one of the good guys. I don't know. Who knows?
There's also some news this week about the Grimsby mosque bombers. These are far-right extremists. So this is one of the things that happens, I think, quite often. You get little stories. When it comes to the far-right doing attacks, this is after the Lee Rigby murder in London. Mosques in Grimsby were bombed. They have been convicted, but it hasn't actually made a big splash in the news. When it's Islamic terrorism, it seems to be a lot bigger. It seems to be all over the place, on the front pages and at the top of the bulletins.
Well, yes. I mean, I've got my own suspicions about both far-right and Islamist terrorism related to the Gladio structures, which have been operated by Western intelligence services for many decades. What was happening during the Strategia di Tensione, the strategy of tension in Italy in the 1970s, is that both left-wing and right-wing terrorists were being encouraged and manipulated by the security services in order to create an atmosphere of fear and terror so that they themselves would have more power to control events and prevent certain political outcomes they didn't want to see. And what it mostly looked like in that case was preventing the Italian Communist Party from joining the government. And all of this has been documented by Daniel Ganser in his book NATO's Secret Armies, and by Imposimato, who was the head of the Italian Supreme Court, in his book that came out at the end of last year. So I, whenever I hear about Al-Madja Haroun or the English Defence League, both of which were born in Luton, I tend to suspect that their strings are being pulled. And if you remember, we did a very comprehensive study of what happened in Norway with the Breivik massacre. Was he really acting alone? These kind of questions have to be asked, because the NATO intelligence services, I'm afraid, have got a track record of encouraging terrorism of various kinds in order to achieve their objectives.
Well, just one basic fact to do with the Breivik massacre was that the police refused to launch the helicopter, even though it was available. They were twice requested by the anti-terrorist police in Norway to launch the helicopter, because they had the number of Breivik's car in Oslo, and they wanted to follow it to see where it was going. And yet the twice the commander who was in charge of the helicopter at the time refused to launch the helicopter. Very strange, very suspicious. The first time it was used that day was something like 8 o'clock in the evening. The police helicopter went off to cover some problems that had been happening at a nightclub on the outskirts of Oslo, but not to follow the terrorists.
Yes, and that tends to suggest that there may be some people within the structure who are actually facilitating things, which would be very, very much like what happened in Italy in the 70s. And if you think back to the Boston bombing, I'm not quite sure what happened in Woolwich, but the Boston bombing, there's lots of video that shows that the people who looked as if they carried out the attack were actually Kraft limited private security people, and they had black backpacks on, like the bomb that went off, and when they left the scene, one of them had lost his backpack. And the Tsarnaev brothers had contact with the intelligence services, as had the two people convicted of the Woolwich murder.
That was an incredible tweet, wasn't it? A visual tweet with two pictures of that guy you're talking about, the Kraft security guy, saying, "Hey, bro, where'd your backpack go?"
Indeed. The fact is that we don't know what happens during these events, but we do know that the Western intelligence services, NATO intelligence services, it's not just them, of course, the FSB in Russia and Mossad have also got a track record in this sort of department. They carry out attacks, or they facilitate attacks, or the technical term is lie hop or my hop, let it happen on purpose or made it happen on purpose. But if you let something happen, that's very similar to making it happen. So in the Breivik case, where the helicopter is not scrambled as it should be, that may be a lie hop, letting it happen on purpose. And of course, what can happen is that there's a series of cutouts involved. So when Lee Harvey Oswald, it's the 50th anniversary of the Kennedy assassination, I don't believe he did carry out the attack, but he's been put in place to take the blame. And there's a whole process involved in doing these kind of operations. And they've been uncovered by the Italian police force, for example, in the case of Italy, carrying out investigations over 30 years. So Imposimato was the head of the Italian Supreme Court there, was the investing magistrate, for example, in the Moro case, where the Prime Minister was kidnapped and assassinated, supposedly by the Red Brigades. But the police investigation has shown that the Red Brigades themselves were infiltrated by the security services. And this isn't just an Italian phenomenon, it's a NATO phenomenon, which means MI6, CIA, etc.
Martin, back to this week, and US intelligence is showing Palestinians bombed Flight 103. That's the famous Lockerbie crash, 1988, I believe it was. Previously undisclosed evidence held by US intelligence authorities supports long-held suspicions that a Palestinian militant group, rather than Libya, masterminded the Lockerbie bombing, a new investigation claims. On the 25th anniversary, the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103, which led to the deaths of 270 people, a special report by Channel 4 News claims a CIA agent, Dr. Richard Fuis, was given detailed information from within US intelligence and from 15 high-ranking Syrian officials in the immediate years after the December 1988 bombing.
Well, yes, and we've been told a lot of fibs about this over the years. There's several major theories about this. One is obviously the one that the mainstream have been peddling for ages, which is the Libyans did it, which always seemed very implausible to me, because it implied that Megrahi had put his bag on the plane in Malta. It then flew to Frankfurt, and the bag was transferred at Frankfurt onto the plane, which then flew on to London without any passenger with that piece of luggage. Most improbable. The other suggestion is that the bomb went on in Beirut, where the plane which blew up had originated, because you imagine there was a connecting flight supposedly took the bomb on. But it makes much more plausible that the bomb went on in Beirut. Now, if the bomb went on in Beirut, there are two possible theories that are floating around. One is that it was the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine General Command who did it. On an Iranian contract, because they were trying to revenge the shooting down of the Iranian Airbus, which had taken place sometime previously. You remember, they'd shot down an Iranian plane flying to Mecca. And the way they got the bomb onto the plane was that the CIA have a drugs run from Beirut to New York, and they put a bag every week on that plane, which was full of heroin. But that week that it went on, the bag wasn't full of heroin, and it was never checked. It was actually got a bomb in there. The other theory, put out by Susan Lindau, who's an ex-CIA agent, and people can look all this up themselves, is that in actual fact, it was two factions within the CIA who were fighting about the drugs run, and people were flying back. Her contention is that people were flying back on that plane to report the CIA's drug dealing activities in Beirut. The drug dealers couldn't allow that, so they were the ones, the CIA drug dealers, who blew up the plane. I tell you what, all of this is very speculative, but one thing is absolutely certain: it wasn't the Libyans who carried out the attack. And the reason why Megrahi had to be released and sent back to Libya, if you remember, they said it was because he was going to die of cancer and all the rest of it. But the reason was, his appeal was about to come up in the Scottish courts, and a former Scottish inspector in the police service was going to testify that the CIA had tampered with the crime scene, to wit, that they placed a circuit board which supposedly linked back to the Libyans. Now, if you think about it, if there had been a bomb, the circuit board wouldn't have survived anyway. It would have been vaporised. So when they say, we found a bit of circuit board which links it back to the Libyans, it's clearly a set-up job. And I think probably...
Well, the chief witness was bribed as well, wasn't he?
Well, indeed. Yeah. So in other words, we've just spent a whole many, many years talking about this completely to cross purposes, because the Western intelligence services have been playing around in the background. And that's the kind of thing they do.
And lots of missing from notebooks of the police at the time. Apparently they've gone missing. Jim Swire, his daughter was killed on that plane, is one of the survivors that certainly doesn't buy the official line, and he still trying to get a proper, what he says, a proper investigation into the
Let's just put it this way. If the CIA have been interfering in a crime scene in Scotland, I would look forward to the devolved government of Scotland or the independence government of Scotland wanting to extradite those CIA officers and interrogate them. And if it turns out that they have been fiddling with crime scenes, I would suggest that's very serious indeed. Enough to break off relations with the United States of America. let's leave NATO, if that's what it's about.
Okay, bird flu. This is another story this week in the Eye. Experts fear H5N1 research could cause a pandemic. That's the research, not the virus itself. Some of the world's most eminent scientists have hit out at influenza researchers who are trying to make the H5N1 bird flu virus more dangerous to humans by repeatedly infecting laboratory ferrets. More than 50 senior scientists from 14 countries, including three Nobel laureates and several fellows of the Royal Society, written to the European Commission denouncing claims that the experiments are necessary for the development of the new flu vaccines and antiviral drugs. They say it's untrue to state that the new mutations in the laboratory strain of H5N1, which have enabled the bird flu virus to be airborne and transmittable between ferrets and potentially people, have already been seen in nature. The letter signed by 56 eminent scientists, many of whom are National Science Academicians, was designed to correct misstatements made by the president of the European Society of Virology, Professor Giorgio Palu, whom they claim made incorrect assertions about the need to carry out this research in an earlier letter he sent to the Commission. So, Martin, it seems in the laboratories they're cooking up stuff which, if it was to get out, could kill. I mean, this sounds like germ warfare they're doing.
Well,
not
I mean, if you think about it, both chemical and germ warfare have been researched by the powers that be for many, many years. Interestingly, just, I mean, obviously, I don't really feel competent to comment upon scientific aspects of this. Others with more qualifications could have something to say about it. But interestingly enough, there's a Chinese colonel who is, he's part of their armed forces, and he's very outspoken, so he doesn't necessarily speak on behalf of the Chinese government, but he is allowed to speak. And he said this year that the outbreak of bird flu in one part of China was a biological warfare attack by the US on China. Now, that may be paranoid, that may be wrong, but on the other hand, that's the kind of way that people are starting to think because of the nature of the trickery over the years that these people have engaged in. And if they think, well, why don't people believe us anymore when we say we're not involved in biological warfare? And people just shrug the shoulders and say, well, we just don't believe you because you've lied so many times about so many things that, frankly, anything you say in a court of law, for example, would be discounted straight away.
Freed after 10 years, an oil tycoon flies straight to Germany to seek revenge. No, to seek refuge. Russia's most powerful, a bit of a Freudian slip there. Russia's most famous, powerful and political prisoner, Mikhail Khodorkovsky, was released by the Kremlin yesterday and immediately sought refuge in Germany. Less than 24 hours after being pardoned by Russian President Vladimir Putin, there was little indication of what would come next for the former oil tycoon, whose vast wealth once ranked him among the world's most powerful people, but placed him at odds with the authorities. Now, he was one of these sort of transitional post-Soviet oligarchs, Martin, wasn't he? And he was actually in charge of vast Russian resources, oil resources.
Yeah, that's right. He was one of the oligarchs. I mean, the backstory there, of course, is the election of 1999, the presidential election of 1999 in Russia. In November 1999, there was going to be a presidential election. Yeltsin couldn't run again, and in any case, he probably wouldn't have won. And who was going to win, in all the opinion polls, was Zyuganov, who is still the head of the Russian Communist Party. And so the communists were about to win the presidential election in Russia. That's because many people in Russia were very, very unhappy about the way that a small coterie of oligarchs had managed to grab hold of the whole country's resources and infrastructure in the previous period. But then what happened? Suddenly, all these bombs go off. The Chechens inexplicably try to raid into Dagestan. Bombs go off in Moscow and Ryazan, killing hundreds of ordinary people. Putin rides in on a white horse and says, we will deal with this. And the communists then lost the election. Again, very similar to the sorts of things that were happening in Italy in the 1970s and 1980s to keep the Communist Party from winning elections there. And Khodorkovsky and the oligarchy were on the same page with Putin at that stage. But Putin and the Siloviki, who come from the more, the security side of the equation, they basically, once they came to power, disciplined the oligarchy. And Khodorkovsky basically, Putin's deal with the oligarchs was this. You can keep your money, you can carry on being super wealthy and going around the world and doing whatever you're doing, but you are not to interfere with the political process in Russia. That's going to be run by people like me, ex-KGB, people with some kind of long-term strategy for the country. Khodorkovsky was about to do a deal with the Israelis to give them privileged access to Russia's oil resources, and at that point Putin moved against him because, you know, that's against the Russian national policy. And don't forget, one of the problems with this is that virtually all the oligarchs, including Berezovsky, who fell out with Putin as well, were all in fact of Jewish extraction and had dual Israeli and Russian citizenship. So there's a rather nasty undertone to all of this. So the Siloviki tend to be Russian nationalists, and the oligarchs, although they're born in Russia, are of Jewish origin and tend to be pro-Israel. And therefore the Russian mafia, of course, has got a very big footprint in Israel. It's a place where they go, just as they also go to places like Cyprus and so on. Khodorkovsky, I think he was politically singled out, but then the point is that he was not necessarily a good guy anyway. The oligarchs basically still have a great deal of power in Russia, but Putin has disciplined them, shall we say.
In fact, but I mean,
what goes on in
Martin,
Russia...
The very paper I'm reading that from is actually owned by a former Russian oligarch, isn't it? Lebedev.
Lebedev, yes.
This is the I, the independent and the I.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, Russian politics is no different than US politics. It's run by wealthy barons. And people say, well, that's really so unfair. The Russians, it's all these super wealthy people manage to control the process. It's true, but they manage to control the process in the US as well. And I believe, I mean, Litvinenko's book about this, the guy who died of polonium poisoning, was called Blowing Up Russia. And he was an ex-FSB agent. And he said, well, look, I was in the FSB, and what we were doing is we were blowing things up, killing lots of ordinary people, and claiming it was the Chechens so that Putin could get elected. How terrible is that? And I'd say, well, pretty terrible. But then, what do you think happened on 9/11 in the US? These kind of tricks are carried out by intelligence services, whether it's the FSB, CIA, Mossad, or whoever. This is the kind of thing they do.
But it's not surely all the intelligence services that do this, or even all parts of an intelligence services, because they're kind of masses of lots of little cells, aren't they? We're going to be hearing about that in the second hour.
Well, I mean, both the KGB and the CIA have now become a kind of forest of initials of lots and lots and lots of different organisations, many working to cross purposes and so on, with lots of private...
And treading on each other's toes.
And it's all been privatised as well. But the point is that this kind of technique, using your resources to try and steer public opinion by creating problems, terrorism, for example, then claiming to solve the problem if you do X, Y, and Z. The purpose of this is to steer the political process in the countries concerned, whether it's Russia in 1999 or the US in 2001 with 9/11.
Well, from the international to the very much more local. This is a national story, but it certainly applies to us here in Bristol. Council's making £600 million thanks to an unacceptable mass ticketing culture. Councils have been accused of implementing an unacceptable mass ticketing culture after the release of figures showing car parking charges have generated £600 million of surplus profit in the past year. Towns and cities across the country, car parking costs have risen despite overall spending on local roads falling. But it's the combined profit calculated by adding income from parking charges and penalty notices, then deducting running costs, which has proved most lucrative, according to a new study. So they're rinsing us, aren't they, really, for our parking charges? And yet they're not actually... This is city councils right across the country, not just here. And, of course, here in Bristol, we're going to see this big expansion of residence parking zones, many of which are going to be in areas where actually there isn't a problem with parking.
Well, I don't know enough about this story to have a strong opinion about it, apart from to point out that all local councils are struggling to keep their services levels up, and this is running out of resources. I think it's, what's it, £90 million of the cuts in Bristol over the next year, and this is a way of trying to keep afloat. basically. They're using whatever tricks they can to try and get
money
in. Well,
they've looked at people like National Car Parks, who are doing so incredibly well over the last 30, 40 years, just reeling in the money. They put up a car park and then it's just there for whatever, 20, 30 years. Mm. Some of the highest return rates as well for any kind of investment car parking gets you. Yeah. And the councils are jumping on the bandwagon.
Well, yes, and the fact that it's gone up recently suggests to me that they are basically using it as a means of trying to keep their revenue streams up as they're losing resources from other sources.
But ultimately, this isn't even being invested back in roads. The roads are a pothole full of potholes.
Yeah, but I mean, the council as a whole, I mean, this is what they call fungibility. If you've got money from one source, you can then spend it on something else. They need money to do all sorts of things, and, you know, getting money from squeezing motorists is one option to try and keep the show on the road.
So yes, but I mean, ultimately, Martin, this is we're moving towards a situation where the council is taking more and more money off of every single person, and yet actually delivering less and less in services. We've got a story in the Bristol Post this week. Protesters are gathering to fight the plans to close 22 of Bristol's 23 public toilets. Protest was staged this week in opposition to plans to close public toilets. A group of women armed with spades, buckets, and toilet rolls gathered on College Green on Friday morning, last week actually, to raise awareness of the proposals, which would see 22 of 23 lavatories closed by Bristol City Council to reduce costs. So we're getting less and less, they call themselves the Privy Girls, less and less for paying more and more. And in fact, they're talking about putting up...
Yeah, well, you've got to understand that the majority of what Bristol City Council spends, as most other councils, is not actually from council tax anyway. Council tax is a very small amount of the... covers a very small amount of the total of what they spend.
Sorry, I stand corrected. That's today, actually.
Right.
this has been happening. But, I mean, you know, we had Kevin Carhill on here last week talking about the situation with migrants living in London parks. There are no toilet facilities. It sounds like we're going down a bit of a third world route. A lot of elderly people do need public toilets.
Well, that's all true, but it also just imagine the macroeconomic impact of cutting back on all of these things. Like the motorists who get fined have got less money to spend in the shops. People not spending money on public toilets means that money doesn't get spent. Yeah? So the people who would look after the toilets and so on don't get wages, they can't spend money in the shops and so on. So it's a self-defeating policy in any case. But ultimately, as I just pointed out, Tony, most of the money that the local government spends doesn't come from the council tax anyway. It comes from central government. It's central government that is squeezing the possibilities down. And of course, what George Ferguson should be doing as mayor of Bristol and the Bristol City Council should be doing is screaming blue murder about we cannot do the things we're supposed to do if you don't give us the resources. And all of this stuff, well, we've got to cut, what are we going to cut? That is silly. I mean, we have to cut because the government, in a sense, because the government is cutting the money back. But the councils all over the country need to get up in arms and say, look, we can't provide the services that we're supposed to provide unless you give us the resources.
Well,
which means, of course, ultimately, a change of government.
Protester Julie Boston, who's been on this show, seems to protest about quite a lot, of, including the railways and things like that, yeah. Public transport, says, Bristol City Council should provide for basic needs such as housing and sanitation. We know that the cuts are unnecessary and unfair, but we also know they aren't actually working.
Well, that's right. The point is that we've the government is now using the economic crisis as an excuse to build the kind of society that they believe in which things like public toilets, public anything, doesn't exist.
Well, it's another story. British society must not revert to the times of Charles Dickens and leave the nation's poorest families in desperate need of food and clothes. A leading charity has warned. Action for Children said this week that the nation has already reverted to the poverty of the 1940s and can't go back. The scenes of desperation described by the Victorian author. The comments come after it emerged that Work and Pension Secretary Ian Duncan Smith refused requests to meet the leaders of a major food bank charity, the Trussell Trust, and accused them of scaremongering. We heard last week, didn't we, the offer of £22 million from the European Union to Ian Duncan Smith to actually help fill up those food banks. He's actually turned it down whilst one member of his family is getting £1.2 million every year from the European Union in farm subsidies.
Well, yes, and this situation is it's intolerable, really. But I mean, we're reaching a point where there is a deliberate policy of creating as much difficulty for people in the bottom rung as possible. But I think
what's the point of that?
Because two points: A, it means that people who are in work are disciplined. You don't want to end up like these people who are really on the bottom of the pile. Poverty must be visible and seen to be punished, otherwise we can't enjoy our wealth. It's a way of also intimidating the working classes as a whole to accept lower wages. And the other purpose of it is to distract attention from the people who are really stealing from you, who are at the top end in the banks and the military industrial complex.
Another story this week: prisoners are to be banned from getting parcels. This is inmates at prisons. Prisoners have been banned from receiving Christmas presents from their family and friends under new rules condemned as mean and petty by campaigners. The new Ministry of Justice, who of course doing little deals with Serco, the private people, maybe they should be renamed something else. I don't think justice is quite the right word for the way they operate, which have come into force last month. Bar prisoners from receiving all parcels and packages unless there are exceptional circumstances. The rules, part of the incentives and earned privileges scheme, include basic items such as stationery, but also books, magazines and additional clothing. Christmas presents are not distinguished from parcels, therefore banned. Juliet Lyon, director of the trust, I'm not quite sure which trust that is, but anyway, Prison Reform Trust? Yeah. These now mean and petty prison rules just add stress and strain while doing nothing to promote rehabilitation and personal responsibility. Francis Crook, chief executive of the Howard League for Penal Reform, said children are no longer permitted to send homemade calendars or gifts to dad in prison.
Well, this is all part of a, you know, Linton Crosby is running the Tories election campaign, and he's just managed to get the right wing back in Australia. And what he's doing is saying we are going to really target the poor, prisoners, immigrants, anybody that's an out group in the society, and that we're not going, you know, and in actual fact, that is the purpose of it. They want headlines saying prisoners become nastier. But of course, when those prisons, if they're private prisons particularly, blow up in riots and so on and people die, they'll say nothing to do with us. But of course, the people who run the prison service, who've run it for years, know very well that if you push people around and bully them when they're in prison, you're not going to achieve anything, and you're likely to create a problem that's going to explode in your face.
Well, if you've noticed over the last few weeks, various pages up on the internet not appearing, you're not the only one. Me too. O2 amends porn blocks after hitting charities. O2 has been forced to amend its pornography filters after inadvertently blocking access to charity sites including Childline, the NSPCC and the Samaritans. The filters have been introduced by a major internet service provider after demands from David Cameron that telecoms and technology companies act to stop children stumbling across hardcore pornography. But the changes have led to internet users being denied access to a wide range of organisations, including child protection charities, women's charities and gay rights groups. The filters also deny access to the Parliament and government websites and the sites of politicians, including Claire Perry, the MP who has campaigned prominently for the introduction of filters.
Yeah, that is a bit ironic, isn't it? Because she's campaigned for the introduction of filters. Her website's full of the words porn and so on. And that's why the algorithm has picked it up
is, surely, if any of this pornography is illegal, then it's illegal. They can be shut down anyway. We don't need these filters.
Well, the only pornography which is outright illegal is child pornography. And it's outright illegal for obvious reasons, because children shouldn't be made to perform sex acts for the pleasure of others. But most of the other stuff is legal, and basically, as you well know, unless you put filters on, children can go on, you know, all they've got to do is type in, you know, some naughty word and all this stuff will come up. It's a problem. I don't think it's easy to resolve, but you can't, in fact. You know, it's very difficult to police the internet, as they've discovered over the years.
Yeah, there's an organisation called the Open Rights Group, isn't there, as well, that's been campaigning on these sorts of issues. Ultimately, it seems that this and also another website called Pirate Bay, which is being tracked down. Now, all what they do is they're involved with BitTorrent and file sharing, and there is the question of some of the files that they're sharing may be breaking copyright, but ultimately, surely it's the fault of the person that downloads the file, not necessarily, you know, what they're doing is they're taking out everything. That is to say, every single file, whether it's in copyright or not, is now being taken out by these internet filters. It looks to me, as if maybe we're seeing the end of the internet that we've, you know, known since the mid-1990s, 20 years of freedom on the internet slowly being closed down.
Yes, I think that, and they want to. They also want to close down internet websites which criticise governments and so on. Governments all over the world are quite keen to do that. And I understand this year in particular, there's been a massive increase in governments complaining about people's blogs and so on the internet. Incidentally, I understand that we had a complaint, did we not, to Ofcom about our programme the other week. And this is because powerful vested interests do not want the truth. They want the internet to be censored, and that's the way of it.
Well, to be fair, I don't think we should really be discussing that because I haven't actually seen the complaint. It was to do with the programme we did about the Cotswold Water Park. And I just want to say, if anyone is thinking of complaining, by all means, you can write in and complain. But one of the things we do on this show is we always want to give people the right to reply. So if there is a point of view that we haven't included, we apologise. We will include it, if necessary.
Quite
come and sit here in the studio and discuss it, or we can do something pre-recorded or whatever. What we're here to do is to try and represent all points of view, if that is at all possible. Obviously, there's millions of different points of view out there. Martin, another thing that's been happening this year, and particularly for Christmas, it's another Christmas story this week, is we've got 200% increase in the amount of food going through food banks this year. That's three times the volume of food over last Christmas.
Well, yes, and I think that the churches have actually, Justin Welby's, the Archbishop of Canterbury's sermon on Christmas Day was exactly about this issue. And I think that the churches who are actually at the front, who are often organising the food banks, are very much on the front line of this. And the government is getting very annoyed when they point out that in actual fact, they're saying it's your policies that are causing these problems. And the government's getting very on its high horse about it. But I'm afraid if you're going to have a big society where the churches step forward to do what the government never used to do, then you cannot tell the churches what to do, and they will denounce you. Because if you were paying to keep these people, then you could say that those who were doing the job didn't have the right to denounce the government. But if they are the big society, as they are, they have stepped up to the plate and full marks to the churches for doing so and others, but they're also absolutely entitled to say that the government have got it wrong, because they have.
Well, another massive story this week is in Egypt. Of course, we've had all of the precipitated unrest there from the Arab Spring, swapping backwards and forwards of government. The Frank Wisner, the son of another Frank Wisner, who was involved in helping Nazis to escape at the end of World War II, his son is in there helping the Egyptian military at the moment, and the Muslim Brotherhood have been now declared terrorists, Martin. The military-backed interim government in Cairo has declared the Muslim Brotherhood a terrorist group. It's criminalised every activity of the Muslim Brotherhood, its financing and even membership of the group to which the country's ousted president Mohamed Morsi belongs. Well, the majority of the country just about voted for the Muslim Brotherhood, and now we've been told it's a terrorist illegal group. Now, this sounds like a recipe for disaster in Egypt.
Well, yes, and of course, what should happen, of course, is like what happened in Syria. The Muslim Brotherhood should take up weapons and fight this military government, just like the Assad government in Syria. They should get some car bombs, some machine guns. They should assassinate anybody who's a traitor or in any way collaborated with the government. And then, of course, the British government will threaten to bring in air power to support you. This is what happened in Libya.
What about cruise missiles from ships in the Mediterranean?
The Egyptian army should look at what's happened to the Libyan army. The Libyan army was smashed by the RAF, and that's what surely should happen in Egypt now, because they've got a democratic movement. They've elected the president. He's been overthrown by this horrible military government, which of course is supported by the British and the Americans. But surely the RAF and the Americans are going to knock out all of the Egyptian tanks now, because the Muslim Brotherhood have got the same right to military resistance against the Egyptian government as the rebels in Syria have got to rebel against the Assad government. And in actual fact, what you need in both Syria and Egypt is grown-up democratic politics in which both sides are allowed to participate. But of course, just look at the West position. In Egypt, they say nothing because the military government is pro-West. In Syria, they support the rebels, even though they are probably the ones who carried out the chemical weapons attack. And we'll perhaps cover this in the next hour, but that chemical weapons attack was the most serious geopolitical event of the year. And in fact, it turns out that it was probably the rebels who did it, possibly with NATO intelligence support.
Well, time now for the Murdoch News at 6 o'clock. After the news, we review our pick of the year's big stories. Just Martin and I and the mince pies.
On 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 6, power's being reconnected to thousands of homes cut off by the storms. Around 8,000 properties are still without power in England and Wales. But an angry flood victim has confronted the Prime Minister as he visited a village that's still seriously affected by the Christmas Eve storms. David Cameron tried to defuse the confrontation by promising to contact the council himself and to visit her property. Erica Oliveres wasn't impressed.
I just told him...